I would like to propose a podcast in which lesbians from all over the world can listen to lesbian affairs, and that can include anything from flannel shirts to cats, cat litter, cat sitters, hot cat sitters, lesbian affairs itself, politics, radical lesbians, veganism, non-veganism, anything. Welcome to A Lesbian Affair.
Hello, hello, we're back for another episode. This week I have Sarah on the show, who's a friend of mine and also linked in with me via Zoom, as it goes these days. How are you, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's really nice to be doing this.
Yeah, thank you for doing it. It's such a pleasure to reconnect with you, because I realize I haven't seen some people in a long time, and you are one of them. And yeah, it's really nice to reconnect. How are you experiencing the lockdown and the pandemic?
It's kind of a mixed bag, because in many ways, and that's actually how we've sort of connected again, there's actually more things I can do, because in real life, I am actually limited by a disability, which makes it hard for me sometimes to go out and do the stuff I used to do. Suddenly, there's this world based around Zoom, and I can talk to people, and I can kind of be out there in the world, and I'm exactly the same as everybody else, which is really nice. But there's other stuff that isn't so nice. So, you know, not being able to see my grandchildren, and even my kids for that matter, and, you know, and that's all quite painful and difficult, and I don't know when that's going to happen. But, you know, I've been one of the luckier ones, I think, you know, in that I'm retired. So, you know, that I'm not in any sort of financial issues. So far, thank God, everybody's been well. So I actually count myself, you know, fairly lucky. But what about you?
I'm good. I mean, I'm sitting here today with a hot water bottle, and it's quite interesting, because one of the things that we sometimes talk about, and we might dip into that later, is the idea of health and what it means to be healthy in life. And yeah, today I'm having a hot water bottle day for sure. But yeah, it's interesting. So I was kind of like reminded of the times when I did see you, and you're one of these really vibrant people that have a very young soul, I think. And I remember distinctly also talking about dancing with you. Maybe that's where we need to start off. How did you find the lesbian and queer community? How do you identify, and what does dancing have to do with it?
Well, it all dates me. I've been part of the lesbian queer community, you know, for 30 odd years now. I came out late.
You're experienced.
Yeah. So it's been a lot of changes. You know, there are lots of changes and almost lots of fashions and lots of ways of doing things. My same-sex dancing actually sort of happened quite a way along. I didn't do that. About 15 years ago now, that's when I started that, after my kids grew up and I could do it. That's something I'm very, very passionate about, because I think it sort of reflects my general view on the community. You know, in dancing, it actually doesn't matter who you, in a way, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're straight, if you're gay, if you're queer, if you're trans. What really matters to everybody is how good a dancer is this person. And it's just a great thing. So, you know, you're just not thinking. It's a true liberal sort of, you know, you're not thinking about who anybody is or what they are. You probably won't even know what they do or, you know, anything about them other than, oh, yeah, that, you know, that guy does a great rumba or something. I really like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's a special space to have same-sex dancing or to have queer dancing, depending on what groups there are. And I think, as anything in life, these groups have undergone a lot of changes. There have been groups that have closed down. But yeah, let's start with the beginning. How did you find out that you were gay? How did you arrive there?
I came out late, but I think I started quite early. And I think, I grew up in the 50s. Was my growing up time, and I knew that by the age of 12 that the way I saw it, sadly, was that there was something wrong with me. Yeah, so that was quite difficult. You know, I knew that as a 12-year-old girl, I shouldn't be wanting to look at women's bodies, for example, naked bodies, things like that. It wasn't right. It was kind of with me from the beginning, but almost tormenting me. And I think a lot of that was because of the atmosphere then. You know, obviously, you know, there must have been in the papers things about gay men and, you know, the stuff about the, you know, mental health, and that would have been around. I would have been reading it. And I'm pretty sure that that had something to do with the fact that I just thought I had I was ill in some way.
Yeah.
So I grew up like that. And then as I sort of got to my 20s, I was like just falling in love with various women. I mean, and, you know, again, not really knowing what it was, but just sort of knowing that you know, writing in my diary, you know, if she was a man, I'd want to marry her. I'd want to do the again without really naming it.
Yeah.
And then I kind of got to a stage where I sort of figured out, well, you know, as I got more sophisticated, I began to realise there was such a thing as bisexuality. And I thought, okay, well, maybe that's what I am, because I'd always had boyfriends. And I knew a couple of things about lesbians. I knew that lesbians didn't have boyfriends, generally. And I knew that lesbians didn't like men. And also lesbians didn't look like the sort of women that I thought was attractive. You know, I lived in the States for a while, and then, you know, it was feminism, and, you know, and lesbians particularly were sort of, it was just dungarees, and, you know, they weren't feminine, and, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And I thought, well, that means I can't be a lesbian, because lesbians don't look like that, you know, so on and so forth. And there was always these sort of things going on and I thought, well, anyway, I want to be normal. I just want to be like everyone else. You know, yeah. I'd had a fairly disruptive childhood, so I didn't want to be different. I just wanted to have a normal life, settle down, da-di-da. To some extent, I did. But it never really worked. And I was always still, even when I was engaged or married. Do tell me if I'm talking too much. Sorry.
No, that's the point of the podcast. Talking is good.
Okay. Even if I was kind of, you know, there were times, you know, when I was, you know, I was engaged and I was still looking at women, you know, women looking at their bodies and then trying to hide it from everybody and this sort of stuff. So it was a constant torment. Till I eventually, I was married and I had kids, and there wasn't a great marriage. So there wasn't a lot of time in thinking about anything. It then finished when I was 37. Well, I divorced him. It finished. And I thought, okay, well, now I can explore my sexuality. You know, I'm going to look at the other side of me. I've done my bit. I got married. I did all the right things. It still went wrong. I'm now going to find out, you know, what I am, who I am and what I am. Because obviously by the time I was 37, it was a very different world. It was the end of the, coming into the 90s.
It was a different world. But what strikes me is that often we hear these stories of women who kind of particularly, I wouldn't even say it's just your generation. Even in my generation, depending on where you live, these stories still happen exactly like that, where there's preconceptions about what a lesbian should look like or what they maybe don't look like. So there's this idea of, you know, lesbians hate men, lesbians are potentially not taking care of themselves, or lesbians are stereotypically, you know, not feminine expressing, or whatever you want to call it. So that sort of fosters an internalized picture of I don't want to be that, maybe, so internalized homophobia or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's always this thing of, we need to hit these benchmarks in life. We need to be married. We need to have children. We need to have a house, a mortgage, a good job. Once we've kind of done these benchmarks, sometimes people kind of say, well, I've done it now, and now it's my time. Now I can look at what I really want to do.
I like that, yes. And I think it is for me, yes, it makes sense, sort of, you know, there was the decade and the time. But you're absolutely right. I think we get very spoilt, for example, in the major city, in London. I can only talk about living in London. But we get very spoilt by the freedom we have, the freedom we have to explore all the positive stuff, all the opportunities. You know, you only got to, I mean, I live in the village, and there are lots of lesbians, you know, scattered around. There's even a gay pub. However, the attitudes towards lesbian are incredibly old-fashioned of the people on the street, you know. And I mean, I mentioned to a dance school that I wanted to join them, and I said I just wanted to lead. And they turned around and said, oh, no, we can't have, you know, the ladies wouldn't like it. No, it's not right, you know, and basically, please go somewhere else. So, you know, that was 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Right.
So if you just go out a little bit further, it then gets very difficult for women, you know. That's not even to talk about certain countries and so on and so forth, but just here.
Yeah. No, I relate to that.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. I remember when I came out in my city, there were around 400,000 people living there. And there was an internet website, I think it was called shoe.org. And there's only one member of that website in that city. And I mean, in that city itself, there was only one lesbian bar, and I hadn't really dared to venture there yet. And I wrote this person in my city, who was like maybe 4 or 5 years older than me, just to make friends. And I said, hi, I'm you know, a neighbor. Do you want to hang out sometime? And her reply was, I'm really sorry, you're not my type. And just thought, oh gosh, if that's what lesbians are like, then I'm not sure I am one.
So how old were you when you came out?
17. I was 17, yeah.
Wow, 17.
I don't know. See, I thought I was late because in my class, everybody was already at it at the age of 11, 12, 13, you know, the straight sort of audience.
Yeah, that I can't even remember because you're in your 30s now, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in my 30s, but I think it could have gone the other way, to be honest. It's entirely possible to live a life the other way and to come out later. I'm absolutely aware of that. And I think, generally speaking, in the lesbian population, this notion of being a gold star, meaning having never slept with a man or kissed a man or whatever, is very, very rare. Like, there is not many lesbians out there who haven't heteronormatively explored a relationship with a man. It's just natural if you don't have the role models to just go there.
You know, I sort of came out at 37. I'm, you know, hey ho, silver lining, I'm here. I'm a lesbian now. And they're saying, no, we think you've been married. And I say, well, yeah, I was married. What? And when did the marriage finish? I said, well, 5 minutes ago. And they'd say, well, no, you're bisexual, you know.
Oh, no.
And I said, I'm not bisexual. Well, you must be bisexual. You were married. You know, and we, you know, I've never been with, you know, and there was a lot of that about, there was a huge snobbery, you know, I really had to sort of earn my stripes.
That's sad. I'm convinced that's not the case anymore from what I've sort of like experienced from community groups. I'm pretty sure that has changed at least.
Changed a lot.
Thank God. There's rumours that you came to the community group with leather jackets.
Oh God, yes.
Was that a conscious act, you bringing the leather jacket out, or was it something that just happened?
Well, my leather jacket, or everybody else, everybody went out and bought leather jackets. And in fact, when I first started coming, I sort of looked around, because at that point, when I came out, I had long blonde hair and was wearing sort of furry anoraks and things like that, which was fashionable. And I took one look round the community place, and I realised I just did not fit in. So I immediately decided that I was going to go butch, because there was a lot of butch them in those days, right? Nobody looked like boys. So you didn't see hardly, you know, it's not like, it's so different from now. You didn't see hardly anybody with long hair. Hmm. So I cut my hair off and I dyed it brown, and I bought a leather jacket, and I sort of went stuttering into the community place, and everybody's like saying, but you're feminine. You know, doesn't matter what you do, you're feminine, what are you doing? It didn't get me anywhere, so I regrew my hair and went back to being blonde again and all the rest of it. And then I was the only one, and I actually think I was probably in the one responsible for a whole wave of more feminine lesbians who were to follow me, because I was the only one then. And people would say to me that they could hear me, because we had two groups, and people would say, so you're the woman who was talking? And I'd say, yes. But they said, how can you be the woman who was talking? You've got long blonde hair.
Goodness me, that's how divided the gender expectations were? Like, in terms of, like, the butch ones get to talk and the feminine ones need to shut up?
You weren't a proper lesbian, you know, if you were sort of blonde. I mean, there were some exceptions, but very few, and I was one of them. But because I guess I wore eye makeup, it was for my job. I had to look like that, but, you know, so I'd turn up with a smart blonde bob and eye makeup and da-di-da and smart office clothes.
Yeah.
And no, lesbians didn't look like that in those days.
That's so funny. I mean, we've recently had discussions about the butch-femme divide, and these days people talk more about the sort of, like, sexual position type stuff, like are you a top, are you a bottom and all that, which is coming from the gay culture, gay male culture. But what I find interesting is that the propensity to be able to switch or to change or to do whatever is still something that people don't necessarily understand. Like I can wear a dress just as much as I can wear a tux or whatever. And I play with that quite frequently. I don't enjoy just being one.
No.
It throws people, I think, to this day when they see the sort of binary opposites in one person.
Yes, and I mean, I've certainly over the years, obviously, I've had a lot of time to sort of experiment with all sorts of roles and looks and all the rest of it. Eventually, just got to that, is that actually it's not fixed.
Yeah,
you know. And I also got a certain freedom, because I never made a very good. I mean, that was the other thing. I never made a very good straight woman in some ways. I just kind of had the wrong walk and the wrong posture. You know, it was always like, so it was never felt quite right when I was trying to be feminine as a straight woman.
Mm.
Then I came out, and actually I could then be far more successfully feminine, because I was doing it for other women and not for me. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it was somehow
It does make sense. I think we're talking about the male gaze quite often and the performance of femininity, right? So it's a bit of a performance.
Yes.
When you say to a little girl, walk like a girl, she's going to just walk. If you say to a woman, walk like a woman or walk like a girl, she will do this really strange sort of catwalk type of scenario, which is the sort of like gender, the socialization of gender expression.
Yeah.
But I think when you do for other women, when there's such a thing, and we could debate whether there's such a thing as a female gaze and if women can objectify women just as much as men. But when you do it for women, you do it consensually speaking, just on a level because you're enjoying also female attention maybe. And so I totally get what you mean. It's true. But I notice also that now you're in a position where if you're dancing, you want to lead. So that's not the femme expression of things. That's a very fluid expression.
Yes. I mean, when I first went into dancing, I hadn't quite got it right at all. I actually thought, well, and I think some of the women do when they first go in. So you sort of link, and I don't know how useful the word is at the moment, but being more butch, you should lead, and being more feminine, again, quote unquote feminine, meant that you should be following, which is kind of aping the straight world, yeah. Obviously. But I couldn't lead because I wasn't good enough at dancing. So I went in as a follower. I just took the easier route. And then you think that's why things are happening the way they do. And then you actually realise that actually most people lead and follow. You know, it's just part of the dancing. It's absolutely nothing to do with roles or, you know. And that in itself brings a huge amount of freedom for people to express themselves.
That's amazing. What was it like for you to come to the lesbian world after having, you know, had the straight experience? Did you find it overwhelming? Did you find it judgmental? I mean, it sounds like there was a lot of judgment there.
I think I was then pretty much as I am now. I mean, I'm not really sort of scared of being judged or anything like that. So, yeah, for me, it was just coming home. There was some judgment, but it was coming home. It was the first time in my life I ever actually felt that I was right, that I was myself. It was also incredibly strange. I didn't even really know which women I was attracted to. I had to start from scratch. It was like growing up all over again. And I certainly behaved, I believe, very much like a teenager when I first... It was like being a teenager all over again.
I do say that coming out kind of follows with having a second type of puberty. It's kind of this weird thing.
Yeah, for yourself, coming out so early, okay, you don't think it was that early, I guess. I don't know whether you went through a sort of similar thing.
It was interesting. I mean, I was really proud of the fact that I never got distracted throughout my school life. I was always the studious kid that would hide behind books and have a couple of pictures of women up in my room. I remember having one decoy picture of a man up just in case people were asking, but it wasn't a particularly representational model because he's Fred Savage from Austin Powers. Some people will know. And yeah, when I came out, everything changed because I came out before I had a girlfriend. I came out after having read a book and having had a rather severe reaction to the book, meaning thinking, goodness me, this is what straight people must feel like when they watch a film and people are getting it on. So it was a trashy novel. It wasn't necessarily something that was highbrow.
No, I've read books like that as well, but unfortunately didn't take the hint the way you did. Yes.
Well, it was funny because it was a biography. It was an English book, so I also had to, you know, get the torch out at night and translate the words into German at the time. And yeah, it was definitely an inciting incident in the sense that everything changed. Like, school books weren't as important. Community became important, and alienation from family happened very quickly too. So as much as I rejoiced in my newfound sexuality and the prospects of that identity and what that might open up for me in my later life, I also was terrified because it created so much trouble in my home life. So I think coming out early can be really challenging because you're still probably maybe living at home or having family around, whereas if you come out late, at least you are already financially independent, hopefully, and can just assert yourself without having any fear of somebody else taking control or making your life difficult.
So what happened to make your life... I mean, if you don't mind me asking, you may not go into it, but...
No, I think what happened was that, first of all, coming out was taken out of my hands because my mother started to tell my relatives that she's really, really worried that I might need psychiatric help because I'm gay. So that was in the 90s. So not much has changed. And, actually, no, I'm lying. It was even the 2000s. It was later than that. So, yeah. Yeah, that was the first hurdle. And the second thing was that she told my grandmother. And it led to a complete estrangement from her. I was disinherited. I mean, I'm still grieving over that Land Rover that I'm not going to get. It was an old rust bucket, but the pride of my grandfather. So he always said, you can have it one day. And then when I came out as gay, I was like, no, only straight people can have a Land Rover. And yeah, my grandmother, she said stuff like, you know, if you go to a gynecologist, they can tell if you're gay.
Uh-huh.
Stuff like that. So very judgmental, disapproving, but also invasive type of shaming that happened. And I made the choice to, you know, never really bring people home for a while unless it's really serious. It's completely led to estrangement, but it has been the right choice because otherwise the alternative would have been to not live a, you know, fulfilling life.
That's very difficult. I mean, my experience, although I was 37, I, you know, was at my mother, who was completely disowned me for about 3 or 4 months, as it happened. I obviously didn't know, so it was sort of basically, no, you know, you sicken me and da-di-da and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that was pretty hard at the time. And she also, it's funny, isn't it, how things don't really seem to be too different, told all my aunts, and who all, obviously they were all that much older, so they all, I was very close to a couple of them, they died and we never made up, so there was a lot of that stuff, you know.
It's so silly, isn't it?
Same era as you, except obviously, yeah, you know, 20 years on from you.
Yeah,
but similar things happening. So
yeah, I'm so sorry, Sarah, that happened. I mean, it's horrible.
I was a grown woman with, you know, with kids. I could deal with it. I think it's far sadder, you know, when you're young, that, you know, that and as you say, dependent on them for nurturing and, you know, finance and all the rest of it. It must, you know, 100 times more difficult.
Well, you know, scientifically speaking, people would call me compulsively self-sufficient as such a thing. And I'm sometimes a little bit proud of that, actually, because I worked 2 jobs during university and I never really had my mother pay for any of my student stuff or anything like that. And neither did my grandmother. So what I found interesting, or what I've learned through this experience, is that some people out there equate money and financial control with love. And that's just not good. That's not true.
I mean, do you even want to reclaim any of those relationships? Do you know? I don't know if you've made attempts. Obviously, you're older, you're grown up.
Well, it depends on how these relationships have been left. I remember in the last conversation with my grandmother, I said the door is always open, but I'm not going to pay for this phone call to be screamed at by you. And I think her last words were, I'm your grandmother, you need to respect me. I don't need to respect you. I said, okay, the door is open if you ever want to talk again, but we'll finish now. And that was the last words we exchanged. And I think the one thing that's a little bit bitter about these sort of things is that I have learned in my life to cut people off and not to necessarily regret it. Like, I think that the inner defense mechanism is quite strong around protecting myself. And
yes,
I think when we talk about coming out, we're negotiating safety, right? We need to be safe. We need to make sure that we're not, I think, yeah, how do you protect yourself from negative influences? Like, being disowned is a big deal, even if it's for a couple of months.
It wasn't for long. And then my mother was actually quite supportive. But I never resolved anything with my aunts, and that still hurts. You know, they wouldn't have wanted to. And my mother herself wasn't, you know, she sort of told everybody to get sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
People then stopped talking to her. You know, so it was all quite nasty. So, you know, but in the end, she was very, very supportive and got to know all my various girlfriends. And so that was fine. But I had a pretty thick skin, you know, and I was able, you know, I wasn't surprised by her reaction, wasn't surprised by anybody's reaction. And I just threw myself into my new life, as well as I had huge responsibilities still with 2 kids and so on and so forth. So there was, you know, I guess I was more concerned with keeping them safe and looking after them, really, than sort of keeping, you know, I had everything I needed from this new life that I'd found.
How did your kids take it when you came out? Because that's another thing that can be tricky.
They were 4 and 7 or 8. So they didn't really know what was going on. I had a partner with me for about 3.5 years helping me bring them up. And she's still my friend. you know, all these years later, and still knows the kids, and they're still, she's like a part of the family. As far as they're concerned, she's a stepmother, which is lovely. And she was very political, still is very political, and basically said, you know, we need to be open with them. So we never actually sat them down and said anything, but we were always completely open about the fact, you know, that they had two mums, you know, and da-di-da. And unlike a lot of other people at that time who were not doing that with their children, who, you know, sort of wanted to keep it secret, even within the relationship. But we were very, and as they got older, you know, we were very clear with them. Yes, you know, you've got two mums and we talk about it and so on and so forth. I have two boys. And as a result, they actually grew up and, you know, and as sort of teenagers and at university and stuff like that, if they heard any homophobia of any sort, they would stand up and say, actually, our mother's a lesbian or our mother's gay, you know. And we'd, yes. So that's the way they are.
Good on them. That's amazing.
So, yeah. So I think that's, I mean, I don't know whether what I would have done if I'd have been on my own. I suspect I've probably done much the same thing. But obviously with my then partner, you know, two of us, you know, it was easier because we could discuss how to approach it and so on and so forth.
It's very true and very interesting also in terms of the values you might have instilled in your boys by proxy just through living your life and not being compromising.
Yes.
I was just thinking also earlier you were saying you didn't know what it would be like to fancy a woman or who you would even, you know, find attractive. How did you find out?
Trial and error. Sorry.
That's got to be the best answer. No, but I had the same issue. When I first came out, I thought, how does this work? I remember reading up on all sorts of things, kind of, yeah, and just advice just making absolutely no sense. And yeah, trial and error is probably the best advice.
It's just terrible, doesn't it? And I would like to pay homage to all those beautiful women who helped me with that process.
Helped you with your study.
It didn't take me long. It was very, I learned very quickly. So there weren't too, you know, wasn't too much trial and error. But, and I did discover the sort of women that I liked.
Hmm.
But it's an ongoing process because, you know, that also changed as things went along. I discovered the way I thought about it, you know, that I liked boyish women, you know, and then but over the 30 years, it's changed again. So, you know, I have a far more, you know, a much wider definition of who I'd like and so on and so forth. And, you know, and I understand myself a lot better. So it was a journey.
Absolutely. I think it that's the beauty of it. It never stops. And I think you're a very open-minded person anyway, so I'm not surprised that it just, you know, your horizon widened with that sort of thing. And
yeah.
How did you find navigating relationships with women? Did you find that there was tough times in terms of also, you know, going out, holding hands, discrimination and stuff like that? How did you experience that side of things?
I guess they were probably the, you know, the ones who would say, we shouldn't really be holding hands here. You know, I was just like, and you know, I want it all. I want it now. And I don't care what anybody thinks. And, you know, so yes, they would be the ones to sort of keep us safe. And you needed to be kept safe in those. They still do. For example, I remember some of the clubs I used to go to, and I'm sort of talking about the 90s. It was all hidden. You know, you didn't want to be seen going in or coming out. So some of the places, they would actually order taxis for you. So you never actually had to go out and actually hail a taxi because of the worry, you know, that's, you know, of some sort of attack or something like that. I mean, that sounds very grim and very extreme. And I never experienced any sort of attack or anything of that sort. But nevertheless, there was that sort of feeling that we had to keep it secret. You know, you didn't want people seeing a whole load of women go in somewhere.
How threatening, a whole load of women going into a place. I am terrified.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, so I didn't quite get that. I think I was still too, it was like a film for me to some extent. The first time I really came across it, but it wasn't London, it was actually in Dublin. And I went with my then partner to, yeah, it was for Dublin, yes. We went into a McDonald's and some guy sort of, you know, started yelling at us and threatening to beat us up and so on and so forth. You know, and again, there's that whole thing too about different experiences. She was very boyish, still is, very boyish looking. And of course, enhanced it with a leather jacket. You know, I was quite feminine looking. So as a feminine looking lesbian, I escaped a lot of attention. People still all assumed I was straight. I didn't really come across it. But certainly lesbians then and probably now, as far as I know, who were obviously boyish, obviously what we used to call butch, they had a much harder time. Hmm. So
it's interesting what you're saying there, this idea of the exposure of the more tomboyish butch or, male expressing lesbian is interesting. I mean, I've had both. I've been on the side where somebody kind of, attacked me for more boyish looks, but then lately also in other situations being more feminine expressing. I've had situations where somebody would then suggest threesomes in the street and, just do the sort of objectification type of thing. Yeah. One thing that we kind of touched base on the last time we talked was the fact that it's pandemic times and somehow you've managed to kind of get a relationship going. You've just entered maybe the beginning stages of a new thing with somebody. How did that happen? How have you navigated that? Because I think what we're not talking about is Zoom and how it facilitates people also getting to know each other during COVID-19 times, which is probably a very unique experience.
It is very unique. And now we're actually able to meet, social distancing. We're doing some social distancing. Yeah. But it is very different because obviously, you're sort of in a situation where you meet someone and you meet them, virtually. You want to sort of move it on, but you can't do any more than social distance, outside. Well, I mean, you could probably do more, but, it's risky.
Yeah.
So it's quite a different experience and something that I will report on after the pandemic.
No, but it's fantastic to kind of also hear that happens. It should give us all a glimmer of hope that,
Well, yes, and it was very much, about just really... there's lots and lots and lots of different ways to meet somebody. This was the most novel that I've ever come across. And it was all based on just getting to know each other. And now it almost feels like, we're sort of back in Victorian times with a constant chaperone, called COVID-19. So it is a very, very interesting experience.
I suppose you're courting.
Courting, yes.
Well, I hope to get an update from you at some point. But that sounds really, really, just hope-inducing. I was just thinking about, we all have obviously had, we all kind of fall in love in different ways. I personally think it's never the same, right? It feels different with every time it happens. So how did you experience falling in love in those different scenarios? But also, were there sort of moments that you remember in terms of meeting somebody that were kind of different?
I think... At the beginning, I remember the second woman that I kind of dated, I fell madly in love with. Hmm. I mean, I think I'd only known her 2 weeks.
And that's long in lesbian terms.
And I fell madly in love with her and told her that I was madly in love with her. And I was. And she just turned around and said, "You're not in love with me. You're just in love because this is your first proper lesbian experience."
How rude.
Well, I think she was right. I actually think she was right on reflection. I had to learn that, I guess, the difference between love and infatuation. And I was primed to basically fall in love with any lesbian who was appeared to be much more experienced than me. Mm. A little bit with dancing, I have to say. A lot of people fall in love with, think there is, it's called, on the dance floor, they sort of fall in love with somebody because, they don't realise that this person's been, dancing for 2 years and, 3 years or 4 years and, they just seem to be gods and goddesses because they know these amazing dance steps and I can actually help somebody to dance them. It was a bit like that with me. It was just, I got myself a very bad reputation at the beginning, I have to say, because I got through, I had a fair number of girlfriends in a fairly short time. So I got a bit of a reputation for, for being...
I think some people might be envious of that reputation these days, but that's okay. Let's continue.
Yeah, so, and then I kind of settled down into the relationship with a couple of longer relationships. I was very much in experimental mode. And to be fair, I wasn't that different from anybody else. I mean, there's certainly plenty of women who were perfectly happy to experiment with me, knowing full well that I'd experimented with a few others. And most of us were still, a lot of us were all meeting up and swapping in the community thing that I was talking about. So it wasn't a big surprise to anybody.
The famous 2 degrees of lesbian separation. No matter where you go, you're always bound to bump into an ex or to, you know, see an ex fling.
But the interesting thing was that I had expected myself to be profoundly different from women, because I'd had a husband and I'd had a boyfriend or two as well. So, you know, I knew how I was or am in relationships. It sounds a bit negative, but I was certainly very aware that I wasn't particularly good at relationships when I was straight, if I was ever straight. And I kind of thought that that would be different when I became in this new world, you know, where I was myself finally, where I was with women, you know, that maybe the problem I'd had with relationships with men was because I was with the wrong sex.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out to be that way at all. It turned out that my relationships with women were very similar in the end, and with all the sort of problems and so on and so forth that I've had as a straight woman, you know, that it was just me, the way I was in relationships. And that sort of overruled the fact that it was now with lesbians, as opposed to men. So that I learnt. So I have to say now, I don't think I'm much better at relationships with women than I ever was with men. So who knows why? I pretty much do know why. You know, it's just, you know, sort of, you know, problems of intimacy, etc.
Yeah, I think what you're describing there seems really familiar. And I, despite never having had relationships with guys, can definitely say that even just looking at my relationships, there is patterns that repeat themselves. And I'm very aware of the fact that these patterns are not sexuality induced, for sure. It's a relationship with relationships.
Absolute relationship with relationship, yes.
Yeah, it's a tricky business. But it's huge to say, you know, I've got, you know, this hang up or a chip on my shoulder with intimacy or whatever. And even intimacy is like a minefield, because there's like 3 or 4 different types of intimacy, as I've learned only recently. It's you know, sexual intimacy, emotional intimacy, intellectual intimacy. But do you not feel like you've grown? I mean, generally speaking, but
have I grown? Probably not enough. I mean, I have actually grown older,
Sarah.
And I guess that I would have hoped that maybe my emotional development in other areas. Yes, of course. You know, I have acquired a lot of wisdom about a lot of stuff, and I'm very proud of myself for that. And I've continued to learn, and I've continued to grow, and I've experienced some tough stuff, you know, that has caused me to grow even more. But I'm not sure that my relationship, I like your expression, relationship with relationships, has actually grown that much. However, I have hope for the next 20 years or so.
Well, that's it. The hope dies last. And I think you got to have hope. At the end of the day, I don't know about you, it doesn't really matter. It's not a race, you know, who grows the most and who gets the best relationship with relationships. What matters is also just the times of joy you've experienced and the love you've had. And
yes,
the fact that you're still friends with your exes speaks also towards the idea that there is a certain element of maturity there in terms of also handling conflict and walking away.
I think one of the things I'm most proud of is the fact that I have maintained relationships with a number of my exes. Those have become, you know, virtually lifelong. Well, you know, with my the person who helped me bring up the kids. I mean, you know, when I went out, you know, it's 30 years. I've known her 30 years. and on my birthday, you know, everybody that I've ever known since I was out, pretty much, including a lot of the women I dated, are wishing me happy birthday, you know, and I think that kind of says it all. So I respect women, and maybe it didn't work for various reasons, but I think the fact that we've maintained relationships and some very profound relationships over the years, yes, you're right. I mean, that I'm proud of, and that I think does speak to a maturity.
I think it's a sign of a sort of evolved type of person to be able to walk away, but not to necessarily say, well, that's it. I'm excluding the idea of even a friendship later in life. So One thing that we kind of like touched on was the idea of health. And I'm aware that before we talked about this, I kind of asked you, how long were you a hypnotherapist for? And you said 3 to 4 years. What was the journey towards that profession? How did you get into hypnotherapy?
It began when I was 12, again, 12, 11, 12. My mother wasn't a well woman. And at around the age of 12, she developed, I can't remember what it was called, some sort of rash. But it was a really, really severe rash. And it was sort of all over her body. And, you know, she was absolutely tormented by it. She tried everything there was available in those days. And eventually she said she was going to see a hypnotherapy hospital in London, and they were going to try and cure it through hypnosis. Mm. So she went away and she came back, you know, and she said, well, they hypnotized me to not scratch myself at night. I don't know if it's going to work. And they've also told me to wear gloves, cotton gloves. So if I do scratch myself, I won't hurt myself as much, because, you know, she was always bleeding and this and that. Yeah. She came back and anyway, it completely went.
Gosh.
And for the first time in, you know, like a year, it stayed with me, you know. So the years go by and I grow up and, you know, I do all this stuff. And then, but it stayed with me. I thought that was astonishing.
Mm.
Eventually, I think I was doing this recruitment job that I didn't like very much, and I wasn't doing it very well. And it was all going a bit pear-shaped, and I had two kids. And I thought, okay, well, I think I'm going to go off and train and be a hypnotist. So I went along for the interview, and they told me that, yes, I could probably would make a very good hypnotherapist. And I did the training, took about 4 years. And the experience of when you're training, you also get a lot of hypnotherapy at the same time. So the experience, and you also learn to do a lot of marvelous stuff with people. So, and the experience of doing all that changed me. It changed me completely. It changed me. It gave me self-confidence that I'd never really had. It improved my self-esteem. It made me far more at one with the world. And I could do stuff to other people too. But it turns out at the end of the course that actually there's not many jobs for hypnotherapists.
Oh, rubbish.
But what it did do was make me very, very good at my job. So I went from being, you know, sort of not terribly good at recruitment and turned me into this, you know, somebody that actually was on top of my game.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Which, so did you hypnotize your clients? What happened?
No, I never hypnotized my clients, but I did sometimes hypnotize my team.
Oh.
In order to be better with clients.
That's really funny.
And they all knew I was going to do it, but they'd let me do it because they'd made more money that way. and here and there, I'd, you know, help people. You know, I would work with people, obviously, all the time, pro bono and sort of casually over those years. You know, I never set up a practice because basically, as I said, I got no financial support. Mm. So, you know, I was able to keep my kids safe, look after them. So that had to wait. And it did wait. And then, because I was in my 40s then, and then when I was in my 50s, I made the decision to leave work and set up my practice. And that's what I did. And during that practice, well, I really helped people. And I worked with some very serious stuff. You know, it included addiction. It included sort of self-harm stuff. There was somebody who was, he was a neighbor, and he went climbing and he was given a faulty piece of equipment.
Oh, gosh.
And fell and damaged his back.
That's disastrous.
Yeah, he didn't do so much damage that it wasn't recoverable, but it was damaged enough that he was in a lot of pain. And he was actually a pianist. So he needed the movement and the stuff. So he came to me, he needed two things. He needed to be healed and he needed to recover his memory because he couldn't remember the face of the guy who'd handed him the faulty equipment in order to sue the company.
Gosh, okay.
So I enabled him to remember the face and name of the guy giving him his equipment, and he was able to go and get compensation. And lots of little things too that just made people, you know, really, really happy.
I mean, I've heard of hypnotherapy in relation to quitting smoking, for example, or even just losing weight. But how do you regain memory or have memory resurface? Because I feel like some of us might be actually terrified of having that done as well, because, you know, some people who have trauma or whatever wouldn't want to go there.
I suppose you never go back to the source of there's the face,
yeah.
There's the trauma, there's the after. So what you do is you build in distance, not from the face, so you needed to recover the face, but you build in distance from the traumatic event. So they may be, you know, you may have them, for example, the traumatic event they're seeing it, there'll be a veil in between, or maybe they will have somebody with them. In his case, it was actually his partner. So in trance, first of all, trance already distances you, because one part of you knows that you're actually sitting in a chair talking to somebody. That never goes. And you make sure, as a hypnotherapist, that that never goes. They're always connected. So, you know, they're not going back there. They're only going back there as much as they want to go back there. And then you build something else in. So you might sort of say, well, I want you to go back to that, but I want you to imagine you're watching it on a screen. And in that screen, you're watching yourself watching it on a screen. And that's it, right? You build it and then you make it different. So maybe they're seeing it from a different, from above, or they're watching themselves, or they have, in his case, they have someone they love with them, who was his partner. The fool, in his trance state, he had his wife there all the time cushioning him, holding him, so it didn't hurt, that sort of stuff. Okay. You never just directly take them back to the memory. You build in interventions. And if anybody is listening to this, it's very important that they really get the fact that there's always a safe, something safe. It's never direct.
That's so interesting. That's really interesting to know. So is there a person that's not suitable for hypnotherapy? Like, consent and susceptibility to believing in the idea seems to be important in the first place, right?
First of all, the only people that I ever worked with wanted to work with it. So they already knew something, you know, I would never work with anyone who didn't want to work with it. You know, if somebody turns up and my daughter says, I don't believe in hypnotherapy, I say, okay, well then fine, that's fine. You just won't work. because yes, it's got to be something somebody wants and somebody thinks might work and somebody finds interesting. There's no point trying to force you. What happens with smokers, for example, is that they probably have somebody, another girlfriend or something, boyfriend, something, is saying, you really ought to stop smoking, dear hypnotherapist. So you get this very, very, you know, this person walks in and they don't want to be there, you know, and it actually wouldn't matter whether you're the best hypnotherapist in the world. So they have to want to do it. It would be like going to the doctor and not really wanting to go to the doctor to get better. Mm. Hypnotherapy isn't something that the hypnotherapist does to somebody else. What I do as a hypnotherapist is I recognize the various trance states in people. I know from their expressions, from the way they're behaving, from the way they're sitting or standing, there's loads and loads of clues. And if I recognize when they're going into good trance states. So what I do is I use that trance state. I get them to go into that good trance state, whatever it is, whether it's creative, if it's something creative, or good memory, you know, feelings of confidence, all that sort of stuff, success. And I use that to help them with a less useful trance state. And I layer over the less useful trance state and make the less useful trance state
go
away.
That's fascinating.
It's not that no one can be hypnotized. People are hypnotizing themselves all day long. It's just they can't use those trance states to cure themselves. I can.
That's amazing. So you're reprogramming people by using their own sort of interface for trance states.
Yeah, put it that way. Yeah. That's the right way to put it. Yeah.
I'm going to be using that from now on. Next time I'm, you know, busted for daydreaming or not listening, I'm going to be like, I'm sorry, I'm hypnotizing myself.
Yeah. Just leave me alone.
Interesting.
You know, you spend a lot of time. I my sessions used to be maybe 2 hours. And the first hour of that would almost be a counselling session. Mm-hmm. I would actually be figuring out, well, they would think it was a counselling session because they'd be talking and I'd be finding out about everything, you know, very thorough, you know, case history, what their friends would think, what the thing would, you know, figuring all out, figuring out what they, but the whole time I'm watching them, I'm learning their speech patterns. I then feed back their speech patterns and the way they see the world. So they have that. I then say, are you ready now? I do a lot of NLP, which is actually awake hypnosis.
So neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. Yeah. Okay.
So we work with that for a while. So they relax and they get less scared. And then when they've done all that I say, well, would you like to go in the trance chair now? I say, yes, please. And then I feed it all back to them using their own language patterns and their own trance states and their own ways of feeling success, etc.
Goodness me, Sarah, that's so fascinating. I don't know enough about it, but the more I hear about it, I'm kind of going to have to read up on it a little bit more. So you were doing that for a while. You were having your private practice, and then after sort of 4 years, something happened. And I'm not sure if you want to go there, but
I'm very happy to.
It's part of your story, and I think it's actually also quite an important part because it illustrates also how resilient you are.
Yeah, something happened. Essentially, I had been out. I was 58. I had been out partying. I was coming home to a club. Been partying. I had partied all weekend, pretty much.
As 58-year-olds do.
Yeah, they do a lot. Yeah, so I'd been to a club the night before, and had a great time. And then I went to some that was out all day the following day, and then I was coming home 2 o'clock in the morning, as was my wont to do. And yeah, I was just walking along, and I was actually thinking about I had to get the night bus. Walking along 1 minute, and the next minute, my nose hits the pavement. Mm. That kind of woke me up, my nose hitting the pavement and breaking. And there's lots of screaming around me and da-di-da, and people got me up. And then I kind of just said, I'm fine. I just thought I'd trip. And then went running for the night bus, got on the night bus, and people started saying, oh, my God, look at you. You know, you were right. I was bleeding and all sorts of stuff I hadn't even realised. So roll it on. A year later, after tests and so on and so forth, it turns out that I'd had an epileptic fit. Mm. I'd fallen flat, broken my nose, gave myself concussion, and went on medication. And that was eight, nine years ago.
Yeah.
Medication. And basically, yeah, I mean, I was suddenly a person with epilepsy, a person on very strong medication. Side effects nearly as bad as the episodes, which they never quite managed to control. And my life became a very different life.
It sounds kind of scary to think that, you know, from one moment to the next, things can change like that. Also, we've previously talked about the medication. Would you mind naming it? What the name of the medication?
Oh, that medication, I'm on a different one now, which is another story. But they tried me on all of them, but I was put on a very nasty medication because, you know, since they've discovered it actually causes birth defects. Mm. How bad a medication it is. That made me incredibly ill. Eventually, I was changed from that because it was virtually making me psychotic, and they put me on carbamazepam.
Yeah.
The problem was that before I went on the medication, I had aphasia. I was forgetting how to talk. Mm. So I couldn't be left. And the carbamazepam actually sorted that out.
Yeah.
But it was a harsh medication, and I, you know, was never completely well. I was getting episodes of one sort or another, bad memory problems, da da da. Right up until Boxing Day this year.
Mm-hmm.
When eventually I changed to a newer medication, which is called Zimpat. It's only actually been around to use to control epilepsy on its own. It was used as an add-on for a while, for about 2 years, and it's quite expensive. So if anybody is out there is listening to this, certainly for me, it's been a complete miracle because my memory was so scanty that basically I just got used to the idea that if I read a book with, say, five characters in it, I would have forgotten the last character by the time I got to the next character. So the only way that I could read a book, Kindle, was by searching straight away, virtually straight away. So I'd read about whoever, and then I'd move on to, say, Mark, and then they'd go back to whoever. I wouldn't better remember who that was. I got used to the fact that if I watched a television programme, I wouldn't remember the last episode, even if it was only yesterday.
Hmm.
Got used to the fact that I could, you know, greet my sister-in-law four times in the period of 10 minutes, having forgotten that I'd already greeted her. And on top of that, having lots of issues where I started shaking and would get paralysed and zone out and, you know, be all that sort of stuff, which never went away. I got used to all of that, and then Boxing Day, and not really, I did leave. I mean, as you know, I did come to stuff. I always had to be very careful how long I stayed, and I always had to be very careful about travelling back, and I was always exhausted, always, always exhausted, and it still wasn't being controlled. But I lived around it, and I got better, as you do. You get used to it, you get better. The worst side effects of the medication wear off, so, you know, and I could dance again. I mean, all right, if I learned a step, I'd forget it the next minute, but we all learned to live with that. And my friends all got used to the fact that they could talk to me and I wouldn't remember even meeting them 2 weeks later. And my friends were wonderfully supportive. But there we are. And I got used to that half-life. And then I took this new medication and straight away it was like I'd woken up out of my day straight away. And now it's been 6 months and my memory is sharp, sharper than a lot of people I talk to.
Snap.
Yeah. I'm not used to that. But I think that the most difficult part of that, was that I had always been a very confident, outgoing person, you know, huge lust for life, for excitement, all that sort of stuff. And suddenly I was somebody that people were having to help. I was vulnerable. I didn't know from when, you know, when I was going to need help getting up off the floor. I didn't know when I was going to have to ask me people to hold me up when I started, you know, shaking and losing. I didn't know when I might not be able to speak. Mm. I was vulnerable. I didn't have a mask anymore. You know, it was stripped off. I'd always been the one that had healed people. Suddenly I had to ask people to help me all the time.
It's such a tough thing to overcome, because from one self-sufficient person to another, being helped, being the one who's vulnerable, is a position that for me feels extremely uncomfortable sometimes. So it's
true. Sadly, very, very sadly, something yourself.
Yeah, that's true. We have talked about this before. I can relate to the story massively, this idea of from one day to the next, you find out stuff and your life changes and everything changes. I've had periods in my life where I've built a castle around myself simply because I just couldn't, yeah, my energy levels were down in anything. And one of the reasons why I'm sitting here with a hot water bottle right now is because I still have that condition. It's never going to leave me. It's called endometriosis, but there are other conditions as well. So it's this thing of how do you navigate suddenly having to be vulnerable and not having people around you maybe as well, because speaking about these things is a bit of a taboo in society. I don't know how you experienced it, but I certainly experience sometimes that when you do talk about health conditions, which happens when people ask you, how are you? And you have had to deal with it 24/7, you know?
Yes.
It's a tricky thing. Are you going to say, well, I'm really well, thank you?
Yeah. For a while, I just lied, you know, I just, I'm fine. It would only get difficult. It would get difficult when people wanted me to do stuff, invite me to things. And I didn't want to tell people, you know, I can't do it because I've got epilepsy. And actually, even if I had done, most people, they don't get it. And I actually don't want them to get it.
Yeah.
So I would just lie. I would say I'm busy. You know, the number of times I've had just found an excuse, just lied, just said I'm busy that day or I can't do it for this reason. Because I sort of figured in the end, that is a lot easier than actually being truthful. You know, people are all dealing with their own stuff. I don't like it when I need to give them my stuff too.
Well, it's boiling down to this idea of being helpless again, and whose help do you accept? And I think for me, I need to trust somebody fundamentally to be able to accept their help. And I think sometimes when people say, how are you? They don't really want to hear how you are. Even in our community, in the lesbian community, we prize, you know, healthy, vibrant looking women. And no matter what age you are, if you're confronted with your own mortality, it changes how you approach life. Something changes. Yeah, you have that choice between, do I say the truth or do I spare myself also the feeling of rejection when I notice that that person's eyes are glazing over and that they're not really getting it? I also, to protect myself, sometimes lie and say, yeah, I'm really fine. Thanks for asking. How are you? Let's get to the how are you bit quicker.
So it's difficult, but I hope that you have experienced like I have, because the thing that did actually come out of it was A, the kindness of strangers. The number of times that, for example, I was stranded, certainly at the beginning, in a tube station, not able to walk, not able to, you know, get up the escalator because my legs had gone. I'd had an episode and my legs had gone paralyzed. And it was often the least expected person. People would, you know, be a whole crowd of people stepping over me because I sort of collapsed onto a stair. All the people you'd think would hurt, and then, you know, you get this sort of, it sounds awful, doesn't it? But really scruffy looking person, you know, scruffy looking person, just looked as if the last thing they were ever going to do was worry about an older woman sort of sitting there, obviously, who couldn't move. And they'd virtually carry me upstairs and get me help and look after me and insist on not leaving until they were new. And it happened. It happened a few times and I got stranded and I got the most wonderful people helping me. So I learned about the kindness of strangers. And I also learned about the kindness of friends. My friends, you know, they'd see me umpteen times zoning out, jerking, paralyzed, all this sort of stuff. And they learned, and they knew I'd come round. They know I'd come back again.
Yeah.
So they would help me. They would help me until I was okay. And then we'd all start talking again, and it hadn't happened. And, you know, and I felt, yes, I'm still being seen. They still see me. I wonder how your experience is with that.
Wow. I'm still kind of caught up by your experience, because you put it so well, this idea of, you know, learning who your friends are and also letting support in. And it's a very humbling experience. I have had amazing experiences. I have close friends who have been extremely supportive throughout my journey with my different conditions that are rare sometimes, but also really difficult to manage. And I think what I experienced was, I know who my friends are. The ones that were there when I had my pain attacks, and the ones who held my hand and, you know, try to experiment and try to find, you know, certain alternative pain relief sort of like pathways. And so, yeah, I have become, on the one hand, deeply trustful towards existing friends who've stayed with me all through this. But I've also noticed that I'm reluctant to trust now that I'm healthy looking and feeling healthy. Yeah, it's come at a price. I'm, yeah, just glad that you shared your story, because I really relate to this feeling of, you know, your world is open, is vibrant, you go clubbing all night through, and then suddenly you can barely walk up the hill to the station, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's affected me. I mean, what I'm feeling it a bit at the moment, you know, in fact, with COVID, because it's made me, you know, okay, I know I'm vulnerable. I mean, I'm not vulnerable officially, according to the government, but obviously, you know, if I was to get ill, it would be very hard for me just to even look after myself, because it would almost certainly trigger a lot of aspects of the epilepsy. And because anyway, things are difficult to do. So I'm, you know, and it's made me very risk averse and actually not sort of willing to take a lot of the risks, you know, a lot of the back to normal stuff that people are doing. And I've had a lot of criticism from surprising people like my family, basically. So, and that's made me aware that actually, yes, I don't think I would have been as scared 10 years ago. Because I think the experience of going, having gone through that has actually made me a little bit more fearful, which I probably would never have had to really think about without COVID. But I've had to recognise that and actually to sort of almost forgive myself.
Yeah. But that's the unique experience that you cannot necessarily understand, maybe, unless you've been through what you've been through. Like, nobody will know how impactful that was. And as I said, it's a testament to how resilient you are, that you are here the way you are. And, you know, I people can't see you right now, but you've got a sparkle in your eyes. the way you speak is to me as if no time has passed. And if people saw you in the street, they probably wouldn't know that you've been through that stuff. And
oh, gosh, no. And, you know, I mean, and I yeah. dance and no more dream it. And, and the great thing about dancing, actually, the great thing about dancing is that, I mean, everybody actually has... They know, all of them, you know, that I have epilepsy. They know, all of them, that, you know, I have these episodes. But they forget all the time, because actually it doesn't marry with the person who will go around the floor doing a fast step, quick step, or a fast jive, or, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's all part of dancing. You know, I sort of think... They're doing a quick step with me, which is really, really fast. And, you know, and they're not actually worrying about the fact that I could maybe just forget what I'm doing for them, because I have. I've been in the middle of a quick step and I've forgotten what dance I'm doing. And, you know, this sort of stuff. But they, and I have to keep saying to people, not often, but, you know, if I do something strange, I forget a part of a dance, or I have to leave the floor because I know I'm just about to have an episode. And they'll sort of say, "Are you okay?" And I say, "Yes, I have epilepsy." And they say, "Do you?" And I say, "Yes, you know, I have. I've told you dozens of times." And they just say, "Oh, well, we just forget, you know, you don't behave like something." And, you know, and that's really affirming.
But equally also, it reminds us that, you know, if you have any form of disability, be it late illness induced or anything else, it can be invisible, and people can be extremely resilient and work twice as hard to have functionality in their life.
Yes.
So, yeah, if I had a glass of wine, I'd say cheers to that.
Yes, me too.
So we're kind of coming to the end of the podcast, but I could talk to you forever. So I don't want to spare you the question that I always ask, which is, if you could have a lesbian affair, past, present, a fictional character, anybody really, with whom would you have it?
There's two women that I would like very much to have. So I'm going to go for them, but I can't quite remember their names. They were both in Mad Men.
Okay.
One was the redhead, is Christina Hendricks.
Yes.
Yes. you know, at the time, I just thought she was the most gorgeous woman in the world. So definitely Christina Hendricks, and she still is. It's some years on now, but I've seen her recently in something, and she's just great. So Christina Hendricks, and then the one who was in also with her, who was in the Margaret Atwood thing,
Elizabeth Moss, Peggy Olson, in Mad Men.
Yes. Elizabeth Moss.
Oh, so Joan and Peggy.
I could choose between them, so it would have to be both. Not at the same time, obviously.
Fantastic. I love Mad Men. It's a really good show. Yeah, no, I can see the appeal. Good choice. Oh, Sarah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking part in this.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Same. Thank you. Okay, we'll be back next week, and if you have time, check out our Gaze the Word Bookshop funding campaign. We're still collecting donations for this London bookshop that has suffered in pandemic times, so if you have a little bit of spare change and like the podcast, feel free to give our Just Giving page a visit, and yeah, we'll see you next week.